It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Tina Brown and BHL Bernard-Henri Lévy.
Well, I think only Paul would have the kind of mischief to have an English woman talking to a French man about the state of America. I mean, what do we know? It's insane. However, I will at least say that I'm on my way to becoming an American citizen, as long as the FBI says that my library records are past the smell test, but I'm nearly there. So, Bernard, now you've been on this wonderful journey, this long journey. Presumably, you came to the project with your own preconceptions. Which major kind of prejudice did you come to when you came here that has been kind of blown up by this trip?
What took me here, first of all, I am fond of America. I like this country. I like it since a long time. I was built and shaped by it, in a way. This is the first reason. The second reason is that there was a commitment given to me by a magazine, an American magazine, Atlantic Monthly, and frankly, without them, without Colleen Murphy, to whom, by the way, the book is devoted, I would never have had the boldness and the arrogance of pretending in 9 months of time making the tour of America. It was really his idea. At the beginning, I resisted. I said no. It seemed too heavy for me, and I did not feel able to that. Colin insisted. I had a very great translator for my articles, Charlotte Mandel, who is here, I don't know where.
You can't kiss up to anybody else.
I mean, I'm sorry?
You can't do any more kissing up to anybody. Tell us what you really came with your prejudices. enough of the log rolling.
No. I tell you, it's very important to have, when you don't handle a language, to have a translator who is a real partner is very, very important. So I came because I love America. I came because I thought that between our two countries, not ours, ours, there was such a wall of misunderstanding, such, as you say in Los Angeles, there is a word which is smog, a mix of smoke and fog, smog. There is a smog of cliches, mm-hmm. A smog of commonplaces, which really impeaches us, prevents us to see each other. So my desire was to try as far as I could to go across that, mm-hmm. and to try to see America as it is, with its dark sides and with its bright sides.
But was there one thing that you were just amazed at how wrong you were about it originally, that there was something that you found that was just way different from what you expected?
Many things. For example, the jails. The prisons. As you know, it was one of the purposes of Alexis de Tocqueville when he came here in 1931. It was his commitment, a study on the penitentiary system. And I tried to commit myself also to this study, and I did not imagine the state of the American jails. There are so many good things in this country. I'm sorry to begin with this one, but it is true that when you go to Rikers Island, near Queens, when you go to the prisons of women of Nevada near Las Vegas. Of course, to Guantanamo, where I spent a few days too. When you see that, there is something really disgusting and more than I thought. I don't know why. It is not the material aspect of the jails. They are not worse than in my country. Jails are always, all over the world, something terrible. But here, maybe it is the shadow, the cloud, the dark cloud of the death penalty, which is above all the prisons and penitentiaries of this country, and which really breaks the heart.
Now, you said in the book that you know you felt that Guantanamo was a sort of was in a way just an outgrowth of the prisons that you saw. Do you think there is a real strand of some kind of brutality in the American psyche that makes their jails worse than you say than anything you've seen in France? I mean, I can't believe that French jails are a five-star experience. I mean, they must be.
It is not a question of five stars, but for example, one example, you have in America a lot of people in the American jails or prisons. You have a lot of people of petty criminals, little drug dealers, and so on, whom I am not so sure would be in jail in some European countries.
What are they doing? I mean, are they robbing tourists instead, or are they? I mean, what happens to people of that kind of crime in France?
Des amendes, some fee. How do you call that? Fines. Some, yeah. Fines. Maybe some 2 or 3 days of jail. Something like that. You have sometimes the feeling, in Rikers Island it is clear, in Angola it is clear too, you have sometimes the feeling that this state, which is, America again is a great country, I think that democracy is really has a great vitality here in this country, but as you know there is a weakness of the power, of the federal power, you saw that at Katrina for example, mm-hmm. And sometimes you have the feeling that the treatment of the social question becomes a treatment by a penal system. Social question being transformed into a penal question. You have a problem, for example, with poverty. You have a problem with addiction to drugs. Okay, jails. That's why this is one of the countries in the democratic world where you have the biggest proportion of prisoners. So all this, for me, this was a surprise. The state of the jails in this country. The jail of Angola, for example, near New Orleans, at the end of the world, I would say, of Louisiana, which has two peculiarities. Number one, it only admits people, men, who have very long-term penalty, lifelong or death penalty. And number two, because of the law of Louisiana, there is no parole, which means that there is no way to get out of there. If they are condemned to a death penalty, if they are condemned to lifelong penalty, they will spend all their life there. They will only go out in a coffin. This sort of absence, absolute of hope, total absence of perspective, again. And this is, and in this place, which is Angola, which is on the other side, a sort of prairie, a sort of very peaceful, green place with animals, horses, and so on. This is something very heartbreaking too, and very similar to, there was a piece of theater of Jean-Paul Sartre depicting the hell. It might be an image of the hell. Mm-hmm.
Now, as you set out on this journey, it was the election year that you set out. And you, of course, immediately after the election, there was a tremendous amount of discussion about red state, blue state America, and how the blue states don't understand the red states and so on. Did you feel yourself that this cliche of the red state, blue state is an accurate depiction, and that indeed blue states and red state, there is no point of understanding? Did you sense that as you traveled or not?
Yes, of course, but I don't know if it is the real, if the real line between the political forces. I'm not sure that if this is the best way to describe it. I think that there is, for example, what I felt after my encounters with these or those, after having met so many people. I feel, for example, that the partitions in foreign policy are more important than these ones. I feel that some of the religious oppositions in this country count more and are more decisive than these blue and red opposition. I'm not sure that you can. The Republican and Democratic opposition, the blue and right opposition, might be the worst way of describing, of depicting the reality of the strong debate which is going on in this country, because what surprised me more I thought from abroad, America has the image of a country where there is no ideology. Pragmatic country, no ideas, commerce, market, and so on and so on. And what surprised me is the contrary. The intensity, vitality, right or wrong, whatever be your position, of the political debate going on here.
Well, of course, you arrived at a time when the political debate had never been more intense than at that election time.
Exactly, yeah.
And during your travels, I mean, you spent quite a lot of time with the so-called neocon intellectuals. Frankly, I thought you were way too nice to Bill Kristol, but that's beside the point. And you feel, I think, don't you, that all the intellectual energy is on the right now and not on the left. How can that be, really, when the major idea of the right in the last few years has been the invasion of Iraq, which you feel is a bankrupt idea? So why are you so admiring of the intellectual energy of the right?
I don't admire it, not at all, and I don't think that I would not say that I admire Bill Kristol at all.
Now he tells me.
No, what I say, I try, coming from abroad and trying to have a fresh and a honest look at all that, I did not want to describe America as black and white. We are black and white, you and me today, but not America, we are English and French. So I try to be honest. When you see this phenomenon of neoconservatives, you have to separate two things, in my opinion. On one side, there is the idea of spreading democracy all over the world, the idea that Milosevic or Saddam Hussein or Mullah Omar are real enemies and have to be downthrown, overthrown. This is not bad. A democrat, somebody who is in favor of the right of intervention in the cannot be against that. This part of their thought, you cannot honestly say that it is bad. And I would even say, this is what I say in the book, that I prefer a man who thinks that democracy is good for all over the world, that there are not some countries who are worth democracy and others which are unworthy democracy. I prefer that to some old Jacksonian or Jeffersonian politician who think that democracy is good for America. America has to close its borders and never mind what happened to the rest of the world. Prefer that. Now, the problem begins when you see how they implement this bright idea that democracy is okay for all over the world. I think that the big problem of these guys is to think that democracy, you produce it all over at a glance. It is not like that. Democracy is a task, painful, very long, has to be prepared. It is not just they transform their old messianism of their fathers, Irving Kristol and so on, in a democratic messianism. It is a mistake. Second big mistake, they pretend to be Wilsonians. They are not Wilsonians. Woodrow Wilson, president of America at the time of the first, at the beginning of the century, after the First World War, he built the League of Nations. He was a true multilateralist. They cannot pretend to be Wilsonian. They are just a bullish American thinking that they can go to war alone and so on. And third, the big trouble for me with these guys is that, as I said to Kristol a few days ago, I told him, I don't understand when I go to a restaurant, if I went to the restaurant with George Bush, God does not, but
I can't see
I would take a first course, I would take a second course, maybe I would take a dessert, that's all. You, Kristol, you take the whole menu. You take the foreign policy,
And meanwhile, he's gone to bed anyway, so...
You take, of course, and you go till the bed, of course. And you take the abortion, the anti-abortion movement, you take the moral values, you take the death penalty. He even takes the creationism crookedness. So this is the problem. So if you want to be honest, you have to stress on the two points. It departs from an idea which is not infamous, defend democracy. We cannot be against that, it's my feeling, and it goes to a policy which is absolutely disgusting.
Now, which Democrats, I mean, was there anybody on the left that you met that you didn't feel was bankrupt of ideas but had a real something to say for America? Who did you meet on the Democratic side that impressed you?
I met, thanks to Tina Brown, a great woman, called Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh.
Ah, that's true, must be said. Hillary Clinton is not the worst candidate and politician you have in this city and in this country.
Well, tell me now, you've traveled though through America now and you've interviewed so many people, you know, in the middle of the country and in the red states and so on. Did you feel the people that you met on this, these travels, would they accept Hillary Clinton as president? Would she be able to win this, these people?
I don't know. I think that the day she will really run for office, there will be, I can foresee, there is a piece in the book, a chapter in the book where I remember that I was in another life a novelist, and I tried to imagine the political climate. When she will really run for office and when the American people and especially the big Republican mummies and dedicated dads will discover that this woman will enter in the very Oval Office where was committed the hugest crime against humanity we ever saw, which is a blowjob of Bill Clinton. Bill Kristol might need one also, but Bill Clinton. I think that this moment, which
we got to blowjobs very fast. I had them, you know.
Which is hard. I try to compete, my dear Tina. I try to compete. This moment, which is hard to imagine, I think that you will have a real psychodrama at this moment, and then there will be a moment where political programs, great ideologies, and so on. But I say I joke, but it is serious and it is sad. I fear that being considered the huge puritanism which runs in this country, the huge hatred which exists against this couple, Bill and Hillary Clinton, considering also the anti-feminist feeling which remains in some parts of the depths of the on the depths of the country, you will have all these things which will come up, and this we cannot imagine the effect of it. Fortunately, there is not only Hillary Clinton. I finish my answer to your question. There are other great guys. There is one man who really impressed me a lot, more than impressed me. I was fascinated by the charisma of the guy, by the ideas he defends, and by the way in which he defends them. His name is Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And I was impressed. Why? Because, of course, he's a sort of African-American. But he's an African-American who, for the first time, does not play on guiltiness. He does not say to America, you are eternally, you are guilty a little. And in fact, you are guilty for what happened and so on. But he plays it in another way, maybe because his father is not the inheritor, the descendant of a slave of Louisiana, but a man of Africa. Maybe because he got the thing, he plays on seduction, on positiveness, more than on guiltiness and accusations. That's why I think that he could have, and I spoke with many people about him in deep America, I think he could have a chance.
Mm-hmm. I think he could cross over. How does Barack Obama stay authentic?
How does he stay?
Authentic. How does he stay authentic? I mean, he is, I agree, it was the only authentic moment in the Democratic Convention was when he spoke. It was a real moment. It suddenly felt the hairs on the back of your neck stood up and you felt this is real, this is something happening here. But in the culture that we live in, political culture and media culture of endless sound bites and spin and fakeness and handlers and consultants and so on, is it possible for a real authentic man, a real talent like that, is he going to have to change too much to really be able to get through?
If he does not hire Bob Shroom, he might might remain authentic.
Yes.
He might. Yeah. No, the problem, you know, I met some of these. No, they did a good job, of course.
They took Kerry till
48%. But I met so many of them. And what the trick with these guys, I was so surprised. I went to them, I had plenty of interviews and so on, and I asked them, what are your ideas? What is your program in order to win the battle of ideas? they always invariably answered me to make a good fundraising. To win the battle of money. Yeah, I said, okay, got it, but to have to get money for what? To get even more money and to get even more fundraising. There is something which doesn't work.
No, no, it's
this
the worst
is one
thing.
Of the problems of the left, really.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's the problem probably of the right as well, but it is the problem of political process
No, because on the right you have the neoconservatives, which you can think whatever you want about them, but Wolfowitz, for instance, you may hate or love, but he is a man who tries to make who tried to make politics out of ideas.
That, you have to say that, yeah.
It is a fact.
Yeah. There's a very good, I think, description in the book of the sad day at the Clinton Library in Arkansas when you describe, you know, the sadness of it all, the rain, the terrible rain that day, and the gloating Bush crowd, and pallid, poor pallid President Clinton just recently had a heart attack, and you felt that it was a real end, you know, of that whole sort of mystique. Do you feel that Clinton's legacy is going to be dismal, or do you think that he will have a legacy?
No, I think he will have a legacy, of course. I think Clinton was the Clinton era belongs to this great tradition of great America. I think really so. Even if he did mistakes, even if he did not succeed in a few, especially of his great projects, there was a soul, there was a project, there was a movement in that which will be a legacy. This day, it was terrible, of course, for all the reasons you said, and also there were two terrible scenes. First of all, it was just after the Democratic defeat. And the Democrats were like ghosts. You know, at the end of La Recherche du Temps Perdu of Marcel Proust, you have the bal des Guermantes, the bal of the Guermantes. All the heroes of La Recherche, the research of the lost time, coming back, but 30 years after, completely decayed, like phantoms and ghosts of themselves. This was the Clinton inauguration of the library. All the Democratic establishment, not all of them, there are a few here who were vivid and young, but except those. Really, it was a ball of ghosts. This was one thing, because of the defeat. Defeat is a terrible enemy for politicians. And second, the only thing which was not foreseen when Bill Clinton planned its inauguration, he planned it the very day he entered in office, as you know. The very day, with this madness about memory and museums you have in America, the very night a president takes on in office, he decides which day will be the inauguration of the library in a few years. What was not foreseen is that there would be the presence of all of the current president, the president running in office, and the past president. And which was not foreseen is that Gerald Ford would be ill this day, another one will be absent, that George W. Bush Jr. will be the current president, so it was at the right of President Clinton, that the former president George W. Bush will be on the left side, the two wives were on the two sides too. They believe in God, so they thought that the sky was with them, the bad weather voted Republican, and you had the poor Clinton, pallid, taking the hand of his wife like this. It was charming, by the way. And the four Bushes with very strong coats, a sort of arrogant smile. God is blessing Republican ex and present presidents. Yeah. It was a nightmare. It was a nightmare.
It's true.
But America.
But you're so right, because in fact, I mean, Al Gore said to me that he was standing near Barbara Bush and she said to him, somebody up there doesn't like him.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which was a charmingly graceful response. Now, can we just talk about sex for a bit? Let's just get back to sex here, since you raised it. You know, one of the major differences between, you know, France and America is, frankly, the attitudes, you know, to sexuality. It's every time there is any kind of scandal in America involving, you know, sex, we read some lofty piece saying, well, of course, in France, everybody's laughing up their sleeve because, you know, this is not the way things are done in France. Everybody has a mistress in public life. It's completely taken for granted. And America is just this bourgeois, you know, totally puritanical culture. It's a ridiculous state of affairs. I mean, what is this an unbridgeable divide? I mean, is this a real huge difference? Or really, in public life in France now, is that an old-fashioned concept? I mean, can major politicians truly have mistresses and behave sexually any way they like and it doesn't impact on them?
I don't think it is a real difference. Number one, you have a lot of French men who have not mistress, who are in love, with their wife and who are not mistress. Number two, you have a lot of American men, even in politics, who have mistresses, and a lot of them. The difference is that in France, as far as today is concerned, till today, in France, there is something, which is the right of privacy, the right of secrecy, the idea that if a president wants to have an inappropriate behavior in his office, it is his problem. It does not regard the nation. In France, this is the point. It is not that we have more mistresses and that you have less and that when one president has one, it is a nightmare. No. The point is that there was a long battle during decades in France for the right of secrecy. And in America, what happened with Clinton, for me, was really more than disgusting. It was absurd. It was all the politics of the biggest power in the world suspended to that was terrible. And what is even more terrible for me, and this I tell it also in American Vertigo, it was really a bad surprise. One day I was in Berkeley and I met some people whom I admired from far a lot, who did and who were doing quite a great job against the war in Iraq and in favor of the enlistment of citizens for the next election. The people of MoveOn.
MoveOn.org.
MoveOn.org. Great organization, inheritors of the radical movements of the 60s, in a way my political culture. I was so pleased and honored to meet them. And we discussed, and I asked them, but what does MoveOn mean exactly? And the woman who talked with me said, yes, we took birth at the moment of the Lewinsky-Clinton affair, and our complete slogan was censor the president and move on to real problem. Censor, I don't know if it is exactly,
yes,
censor the president
censure.
And move on to real problems. I said, what would you say, censor the president for what? She told me, because he made a fault. This inappropriate behavior is not allowed, is very bad. I say, you really believe that it is a crime which should be censored? She told me, not to the point of an impeachment, of course, not to the point of this huge scandal, of course, but that this should be condemned, yes. So I discovered that even in this wing of the political spectrum, even in this part which is the most noble on my point, there is some remnants of Puritanism and some préjugé of the same kind. Mm-hmm. And this for me was really a bad surprise.
Well, this is what you said about your time in America recently in New York Magazine. Sometime in your private life, you have a mistress you love. You spend some time in a grand hotel with good room service and great champagne, and you separate. And when you are really in love, you think, can I wake up with her every morning? That's exactly what I did with America. America was a great mistress. I had a great bleep with America. And it was like a weekend in the Hotel Ducat. So,
no,
it was
no,
good
no.
for
Week,
you. Weekend. It was good for you, but was it good for us? That's the point. I mean, why should, at the end of your sort of whole travels through America, I mean, what should we take away from your book? I mean, what does it do for us to have you, as a Frenchman, come here and tell us stuff about America? Where do you get off, as they say?
First of all, for me, I got something marvelous in this travel and in this book, which is to discover really a country which I thought I knew and which I did not know. And this, for me, this is what I meant by this metaphor, which has not been accurately...
It's a hostage to fortune, I can tell you.
...quoted. There was something like that, a relationship with a country which I knew from time to time, in very special circumstances, to see it really in his dark and bright side, as I said at the beginning, was something great. What you can, American, draw of this book, I don't know, maybe nothing, maybe something, maybe a mirror, maybe, I don't know, maybe a fresh eye who sees in a different way things you yourself know or won't prefer not to know. I ignore that. What I can say, the conclusion of this book, the general spirit of this book is the following. I think that you have in America the roots of the best democracy in the world. I think that really this democracy, when you go deep inside the country, is still living, is still vivid, is still youthful. I really believe that, even in the red states. Even in the red states, my dear Tina, even there.
I believe you.
And I think that you have, but this is an accident of history, you have a hijacking like for planes. You have a hijacking of a great democratic tradition by a group of people who are sometimes dishonoring it. This is my conclusion, and this is the situation.
Okay. Thank you.